And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris. It is Thursday, October 14th, we are here against all odds, against all coffee spills, against all, well, it's not a time change right now. It's just being
hotel situations.
Yes. Hotel internet is always a gamble for podcasts, live shows, all of the above. But we are here, and I have the motor skills of a toddler. As I've learned many times, I often spill coffees on my desk. And today was one of those days right before we were supposed to go live, which is very convenient. Nice. Yeah, so how's everything going? You made it. You're in Arizona. You've seen baseball. That's great.
Yes, it was fun. AFL baseball is amazing. It's so strange. They're all wearing their own uniform, so you know, like there, it seems like it's always an all-star game. there's no concept of team at all because they're all from different teams, and they frankly don't really care if they win or lose. All they want to do is homer or strike the guys out, and they're all kind of there to increase their innings, increase their plate appearances, add to the season, maybe showcase themselves for a trade. But the big get last night was talking to Tristan Casas and then watching him launch one deep into the night. But I also enjoyed talking to Mr. Lars Nootbaar and a few other guys for a story I'm doing down here.
Yeah, I was a little surprised that Lars Nootbaar was there, since we saw him quite a bit in the big leagues this
year. One of the few that had big league experience, and there was some question that he would even report had the Cardinals advanced. He was on the taxi squad, I believe, and somebody like Shea Langeliers, who was supposed to be there, the catcher for the Braves, is not reporting right now because a little something called the NLCS.
Yeah, he's a little busy.
He's on a taxi squad for the Braves there. I think he's going to try and stay ready for them and not get injured at an Arizona Fall League game while they might need him.
So we got a big Game 5 tonight, Giants-Dodgers happening, and it is the kind of game that we've seen Logan Webb do it once. I still have some doubts about whether or not he can do it twice, because that Game 1 performance is almost impossible to replicate against anyone, let alone a Dodgers lineup as good as this one. But it's going to be Logan Webb against Julio Urias. I'll put the question to you. Can Logan Webb do it again? Or can Logan Webb do it for four or five innings like he did in Game 1 and turn it over to maybe Kevin Gausman and then Camilo Doval, who's rested? And of course, you've got McGee and you've got Rogers. Like, is there a path for the Giants to do it in a slightly different way than they did in Game 1 and come out with this W?
Well, as the king of waffles, I have to be on both sides of this issue. I think, just to be serious about that, like I know that it frustrates some. Like, I've actually been sort of taking a task for it, but I just think there's nuance in baseball. So I'd like, you know, I try to see both sides. And in this case, what I would see is Logan Webb actually did break out some surprises for that last game. It was the second most he'd ever thrown his changeup. And he'd kind of been going away from the changeup and become more of a sinker slider guy, you know, throughout the season. So that was a wrinkle for the Dodgers. And I think that it worked a little bit hand in hand with the strike zone that day, because if you remember, he was getting strike zone. He was getting extra strike zone off the edge of the plate. I think it was off the edge of the plate to righties. And so that allowed him to throw some backdoor changeups, to play with a wider strike zone left to right, that let him kind of take advantage of that changeup. Now, does he have the same strike zone tonight? Does he have the same element of surprise if he comes out there and throws a ton of changeups? I don't think so. So I don't think it'll be the same dominant performance. I don't think he'll go as far, but maybe he doesn't need to. The big thing is whether or not the bats support him. If he can give up two or three runs in five or six innings and the bats actually support him, then we're going to go to a tight game that gets down to the ninth inning.
Yeah, I think if you look at it from the other perspective, okay, what can the Giants do against Julio Urias? And then if they get to Urias, at what sign of trouble do the Dodgers go to the bullpen and possibly maybe to Max Scherzer for one? I think Dave Roberts tried to downplay the likelihood of Scherzer appearing in this game. But at the same time, if the season is hanging in the balance, he's available for something, even if it's only for one inning. If it's an outing sort of like what we saw from Brandon Woodruff in game four of the Milwaukee-Atlanta series, that's probably at least a baseline expectation for Scherzer at some point tonight.
Didn't Council say like Burns and Woodruff aren't available and stuff like that? He said, I don't think they'll pitch. I don't think they'll pitch is like, frankly, just BS at this point.
it's like those nights in college, like the Thursday nights, you'd say, I don't think I'm going out tonight. Or yeah. I don't think I'm going to have that much to drink tonight. Back in the day. And then you'd wake up and you'd be like, wow, set a personal record, made some really bad choices, and now I got to go pick up the pieces. Like,
and I don't even know where I am.
Yeah, where am I?
Yeah, exactly. I think that Scherzer is definitely on the table. I think everything's on the table. It's game five. So, you know, the other thing that I wanted to mention about Webb was you had some astute comments from people saying that the lefties that I was like, well, Webb might have some trouble against lefties. Well, pretty much it's Seager. I mean, I like Beatty, you know, but, you know, he's not a threat. And, you know, Bellinger's been playing a little better, but he's not the Bellinger threat that he used to be. So you're kind of circling Seager as a lefty that might worry you. And otherwise you're taking a sinker slider approach tonight against all the righties, I think. So that might be the only wrinkle he has, is going back to what he was and ditching the changeup a little bit more. So, you know, I could see this. I think it'll be tight. I mean, this is really good teams. And then the righties for the Giants are going to be really important. You could cite season long numbers against lefties by the Giants, but that would miss the fact that Evan Longoria missed half the season and Chris Bryant wasn't on this team. Those are two big righties. If you think about it, the righties that they've got that should scare Urias, it's a longer list than lefties that should scare Webb, right? With Muncy out, you still have a longer list of righties with Posey, Bryant, and Longoria. And I honestly, Flores is a good at bat against lefties. Solano is a good at bat against lefties. So they've got a pretty good lineup, you know, in terms of depth and star power to face a lefty.
Yeah, I'm looking back at the previous matchups, Urias against the Giants this year, and they got to him once, one big game against him back in May. I think they piled up 11 hits, 7 runs over 5 innings that day, but a lot of good starts from Urias. He's faced them 5 times this year, and 4 of those outings were, if they weren't quality starts, they were at least very good starts. So it's a tall task, but I do think the Giants, the way they're built with those platoon pieces, they can absolutely throw something out there that could work. And I do have a little more confidence in them with all of their relievers rested too. There's not really any question about like their options, and they're having everybody they want to have available. As Trevor wrote in the chat for the live stream, honestly, this Giants team has shattered my expectations so many times, I don't know what's impossible anymore. It's a perfect way to sum up this team, really.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think they have so many options because their relievers are rested that they don't, you know, throw like season splits out the window. If they think that Jake McGee profiles better against lefties, then they can use Jake McGee as almost a lefty specialist. If there's two, I mean, you have the 3 batter minimum, but if there's 2 lefties out of 3 somewhere, that's when Jake McGee will come out instead of being like he's their ninth inning guy. Because I think Doval is, you know, looks like the ninth inning guy.
Yeah, the confidence level in him through the roof right now, and understandable given that they've had the ice water in the veins, the pulse checks on him on a few occasions.
They said you go back out there for the ninth or something. He said, "I'm ready, Poppy. I got you." And you know, the funny thing is though, you know, even though he's hit 105, the big step forward for him this year was finding the slider. that was the big development hurdle that he had to overcome this year. And he's found it. Because if you just keep throwing 105, unless you're Jake McGee, which I still don't get it. I mean, I know he's kind of explained it to me, and it's about like he kind of has, you know, a little bit of shape on the fastball that's hard to pick up or what. Like, I'm like, dude, it's a fastball every time. How does it work?
And it somehow works. It's bizarre. One question for you longer term about Duvall. Of course, I'm in that draft. It's a slow draft happening in the background with our friend Todd Zola. We're in the 27th round, I think. So it's going to end probably by the end of the weekend, maybe even by the end of the week. Jake McGee had 31 saves this year for the Giants. Tyler Rogers had 13. Duvall's going to have a large share of them next year. But would you start looking at Duvall as a borderline traditional closer as we look ahead to next season? Or do you think it's going to be a little more of a mix and match thing kind of indefinitely in San Francisco? Just thinking about the way that Gabe Kapler has managed that bullpen and the way that this team has been constructed in recent years.
The one thing that, you know, we haven't been able to nail down in the data is whether or not teams really do this to keep players cheap. You know, do the mixed bullpens to keep players cheap. Because, you know, I if you can say that and it makes sense, and you can look anecdotally and say that it makes sense, but it's been hard to prove that they do that in the numbers. If that exists, I don't think the Giants care about it. The Giants have money. They want to win, you know. And I think it mixing and matching Jake McGee and Tyler Rogers in the eighth or whoever, you know, whoever they find next year makes a lot more sense than playing Duvall, you know, early. So I think, you know, Duvall is going to be the closer. You know, I know that Stuff Plus, I try not to just parrot it, but Pitching Plus beats projections for relievers. So I can tell you that he has excellent stuff and location and has a 105 pitching plus, and there's no but his fastball is super straight kind of issues there with Duvall.
Here's a comp in the live stream from Carter. Jake McGee reminds me of Sean Doolittle from a few years ago. Lefty, pretty much all fastballs. Velo not overpowering. Yeah, later career Doolittle, a little less overpowering. Earlier career Doolittle was more like 95, 96, right? So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't Chapman.
That's kind of where McGee is.
Yeah, so yeah, I think that's a pretty good comp. And then El Capitano, this is why I like playing in saves plus hold leagues, frees up so much brain space. I mean, I'm warming up to the idea. I mean,
holds aren't a great stat by themselves, and they're a little bit more finicky than saves, so you still kind of want to know who's safe. Like, the saves guys are a little bit more, in terms of usage, like the holds guys come and go faster.
Yeah, they do.
So there's still a little bit of like the closers are better, but I think you're right. I like those leagues better too, because you can focus on just finding quality relievers.
I like it. I like that category more when saves still carry a little extra weight. Mm. Like, again, there's flaws with both stats. We don't have to relitigate saves versus holds and combining them, but
would you like a 2x saves plus 1x holds league?
Yeah, 2x saves plus holds, I think, is a good balance. Or even one, I'll take 1.5 on saves. A little extra weight just for those, because that's sort of how our
brains
work.
Well, you be quiet, because everybody who runs an auction calculator is like, shut up.
Oh, everybody. I'm a developer's nightmare, because all of my funhouse stupid ideas that are actually like fun, creative ideas
are not
a total
in the auction
pain.
Calculators.
They are not easy things to build from a programming perspective most of the time. Like, I've worked closely enough with people that have to build tools when I have an idea to know that, yeah, I am not well-liked in those circles. So, official prediction. It seems so hard to pick against the Dodgers. It's been hard to pick against them for so long. I think they're going to go into San Francisco and break some hearts tonight. I'll take the Dodgers side of this one. A nice, tight 4-3 game, back and forth. Delivers in terms of hype and energy and fun, but ultimately, I think the Dodgers do come out on top in a close one.
I'm going to go Giants. I like the righties in the lineup. I think Logan Webb might have one more wrinkle and be able to get through this. I like that they have Gausman. I like that they're home. I do think that might matter a little bit. My power is running out of my computer. Yay! Another obstacle. But I'm going with the Giants. Also tight game. Have to find a way to watch it here while in Arizona. And you're going to move with me. How exciting. How fun. Isn't this exciting? You get to see my dirty hotel room. Yay!
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Well, you know what? I'm glad you're giving us all the experience of what it's like to be there, since I'm not there this year. Like, ordinarily, we'd be in the same place, sitting awkwardly at one little hotel desk trying to do a live stream. And, you know, so now I feel like I am there because I've seen the tour. I've seen what the Marriott room in this instance looks like and how similar it is to the other Marriott rooms.
Well, now I'm on the floor.
This is incredible.
I hope you didn't see me in my boxers through all that.
I think you managed to keep your lower half out of the shot, thankfully. I don't want to
a lot of training in the last 2 years about keeping lower halves out of Zoom shots.
All right. On
it's
to
cold,
Houston.
Jerry. It's cold.
Yeah. Actually, let's let's go
speaking
to Houston for a minute.
Speaking of Seinfeld, when I got here, they had no rental cars in the entire rental car structure at the Phoenix airport.
That thing's huge. They had no rental cars
sold out completely of cars, including ones that had reservations. And there was like 150 really angry travelers in there. And I was like, I could do the Jerry Seinfeld and yell about taking reservation. You know how to take a reservation. You just don't know how to hold it.
See, but the thing is, and this is my, I mean, if you've ever worked a job in customer service or retail or whatever it is, like you've been yelled at for something you had no control over, and it feels terrible. So I are similar in that regard. We don't do stuff like that.
I just left.
So what did they do? So they sold the fleet. They sold the fleet during the pandemic and haven't replenished the cars.
I think that first of all, I think it's related to like airlines are understaffed and canceling flights. So some people are going and getting a car because their flight was canceled.
Okay, yeah, that's happening.
I think that some people are still nervous to fly in planes, and so they're renting cars. I don't know. Maybe there's an understaffing issue on the rental car side too. And maybe part of it is people are tired of having crap jobs where they get yelled at and get paid really poorly. And I think that's kind of reverberating throughout every industry right now. They're finding that they have to either pay better or offer some sort of incentive to make the job seem better. Frankly, I think that sort of adjustment has been overdue in American society. If you look at European society, they take the full month of August off. You know, it's just like everyone's like, F it.
It's nice outside.
We're done.
This podcast, it got weird as soon as you stood up and had to plug in your laptop.
Yes, we're not talking about baseball. Let's get back to baseball.
Let's get back to baseball,
you idiots.
Let's go to the Houston story for a moment, just because they cruised through their series with the White Sox. I think I'm most surprised by really is that the White Sox bullpen didn't come in and shut the door when they needed it to. I thought they had enough depth to get quality innings from that relief corps. Other things went wrong, too. Lynn got rocked in game one. Giolito only went 4 1/3 in game two. I just thought they matched up better with Houston than they actually did in the series. the White Sox, we'll talk about them probably on an off-season episode. They're well positioned to make another run in 2022.
I want to talk about the runway here.
Go ahead.
But I think that we're a lot of focus has been on the White Sox failing, or the White Sox somehow having fatal flaws or something, and that the White Sox were just a product of their division. And I kind of want to push back, because if you like, sometimes you just gotta like. I talk about like the blink thing. I don't love Malcolm Gladwell, but the idea that like sometimes you just gotta like take an appraisal of a situation and listen to your first thought about it. And like, look at the White Sox and tell me they're a bad team. Like, what are you talking about? And the people are like, well, they should have like a real second baseman and a corner outfielder. Dude, Cesar Hernandez is totally fine. If Cesar Hernandez is your worst position player, and if Cesar Hernandez and Adam Engel are your worst position players, like, you're a good team. You're a good friggin' team. And they're like, well, the starting pitching, they get really lucky. What are you talking about? It's like Lucas Giolito. Like, that's a good starting rotation. They could go into the offseason and just buy a back-end starter and try to turn Kimbrel back into a serviceable second baseman or corner outfielder. That's all they got to do. And they'll be back in it.
Yeah.
And they may not even have to get a starter, because they'll probably stretch Kopech out. So they might just try to turn Kimbrel into a cheaper reliever or something.
Yeah, we got into the White Sox a little bit on the Athletic Baseball show that I recorded with Keith earlier this morning. That'll go up Friday. But I think the White Sox, if they were going to make a splash in free agency, and they don't need to, I mean, Marcus Semien would be a way to just make the offense even better. You want to go from a top five, top six offense to maybe having one of the best offenses in the league? Okay, you could do that. But
and then,
I don't know if
and
they
then
need
fudge
to
around with Engel. You know, you have Sheets. Mm-hmm. So if Engel and Sheets is your right field situation, like, fine, sign me up for that.
Carter wants to know when the Rates and Barrels spinoff podcast on the U.S. labor market is coming out. Yeah, that's ways to get depressed every day for 300, please. Like, I couldn't dive into that pool every day. And
my suggestion is not to go find the 300 tweet thread that started for me talking about me finding a $50 Oreo in my Oreo pack. Something about stagflation, and it's ridiculous.
I missed that thread.
That Oreo packs would cost $50 by December.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, anyway.
Well, I think the White Sox are
well
positioned, though. I think the question is Tony La Russa coming back? And he said, if the players would have me back, I'll be back, right? That was basically what he said.
They seem to, you know. Jose Abreu said he's in all of our corners, which is a...
Okay.
Sensual baseball thing, maybe, but they seem to go to bat for him at the end, because it was one of those things that got asked of all of them, I think.
Yeah, understandably so. So apparently he's coming back. If they make moves, I think it's relatively small. And this is why I wanted to talk about Houston. I think it's easy to just sort of brush everything aside.
Houston is a great team.
They're really good. And I think we sometimes forget that they consistently are winning. I understand the trash can scandal. We've talked about that. We've had enough of that story. They're more than that. They always have been. There's so many things they do very well as an organization, developing players and being consistently good from year to year. And they've had key players leave. I mean, losing Springer and just kind of doing it again, right? Like, that Verlander got hurt. Like, they've had their share of injuries and departures, just like any other team. And yet here they are, still doing a ton of damage, not striking out, and having plenty of pitching, even though you don't see a lot of their young pitchers, Forrest Whitley sort of the exception, as highly regarded, highly ranked prospects. That says a lot about what they've been able to accomplish as an organization. I think the one thing that really could be a problem for them is Lance McCullers, his injury. Like, if he's going to miss some time, that puts them in a pretty difficult spot. But even still, their fallback option is Greinke. Like, they eventually go to Greinke in, like, game four if they don't have McCullers. And you could be so much worse off than this version of Zach Greinke having to give you maybe four or five innings in the ALCS.
I mean, my recency bias says they need McCullers to beat the Sox, because the Sox just seem like a juggernaut all of a sudden. But we have to remember that the Sox offense paled in comparison to the Astros offense, frankly, during the regular season, during September, any snapshot you want to take. The Red Sox were more like a top six, top seven type offense, and the Astros were like a number one or number two. So, like, you know, I think it may – I don't think it would totally swing the series. Is there talk of him missing him? I thought it was hopefully more preventative, and, you know, he just didn't feel 100%, so we got him out of there.
Yeah, just a little more of a day-to-day sort of thing. But if that turns into an actual absence, that is one of the things that puts them in a pretty rough spot, just because depth...
I mean, injury is the biggest source of chaos in a season and a postseason, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you would need more from Jake Odorizzi. Okay, like, again, you could do so much worse than guys like Odorizzi and Greinke having to step in for someone like McCullers. Framber Valdez seems like the exact type of pitcher you'd want to throw in Fenway. That's from Mitch in the live stream. Yeah, I mean, if you lefties at Fenway, it's a tall order for them, but getting a ton of ground balls, that's one way to offset it. Peak Dallas Keuchel, I guess, would have also been the kind of guy that could fare a lot better at Fenway than the typical lefty.
And also, one thing that did come out of – I did – tried to defend the nerds when the Rays lost and wrote a piece about defending, you know, their approach. And I kind of pointed out that the same pitching approach was taken by both teams. If you look at when Shane McClanahan and Nate Eovaldi were dealing, they were taking out 85 pitches. So we're taking dealing pitchers out earlier and earlier. Everybody's doing it. It's not just the Rays. So that has spread. The thing that ended up tanking the Rays, I think, was a little bit of a Glasnow injury. Maybe the Rich Hill trade was a poor one. Maybe it's a money thing because you can buy depth. If you think about it, the Red Sox had Tanner Houck and Nick Pivetta, and those guys were really good. Imagine if the Rays had an Eovaldi and Sale for $40 million or $50 million at the top of their rotation. Then Baz and Rasmus and all those guys would have been in the position of Houck and Pivetta depth. You know, you kind of push everybody down a rung and create depth by signing guys. The Astros don't have that problem. In terms of guys that can go more than 40 pitches, that's what I was calling it. Like, depth now in the playoffs, like bulk now in the playoffs, is 40 to 80 pitches. That's how little you need to go. And the Rays did run out of 48 pitcher guys, but the Astros won't. You know, if you want to take a guy out at 80 pitches, you're going to have another guy that day that can pitch 80 pitches or 60 or 50.
Yeah, the thing about the Rays, too, that kind of hit me this morning was just that, you know, Charlie Morton is pitching well for Atlanta. There were two places it seemed like he was willing to sign, Atlanta and Tampa Bay. It was a one-year deal, so it wasn't a long commitment. And the Rays decided not to make it, or they didn't want to match Atlanta's offer. I don't know the exact details, but think about a guy that was there last year that they reasonably could have got. They run a payroll in the bottom five every year.
Would have been huge.
It would have made a huge difference. The hindsight is 2020.
Rasmussen into a guy that pitches every 2 days at 40 pitches or something, you know?
Glasnow was healthy at that time. So that factors into your core and what you think, but it's just like if they weren't so cheap on the margins that if they went ahead and traded Snell the way that they did.
I think trading Rich Hill was a bad idea. I know that his spin rate really went down after the spin rate enforcement. It was pointed out to me, and I remember this from my piece, is that four-seam fastballs are affected by the sticky stuff thing more than curveballs. And that's what you saw with Rich Hill, is he was effective even after the sticky stuff enforcement. That's because I don't know why, but curveballs, you retain more of the spin rate, you retain more of the shape. The real thing that got hurt was that zip, that ride on four-seam fastballs that everyone's looking for. That's what got really hurt by the sticky stuff enforcement. Rich Hill doesn't have it like an amazing fastball anyway. So,
but just back to the Astros for one yeah, second.
Shut up about Rich Hill, you know?
Well, no, I agree. There's so few easy paths through this lineup. We talked about Kyle Tucker hitting seventh. This is a guy that is a borderline first rounder in fantasy, buried in the seventh spot. We said before, like, if he's on any other team, he'd hit third or fourth, probably. That just speaks to how well the offense is built.
Do we have any Jake Meyers news?
Now, I haven't seen anything yet, and that looked really bad. Like it looked
like
he
couldn't throw in the game.
Yeah, so I'm very
shoulder discomfort.
Concerned.
It's worse than elbow discomfort, I think.
And he's among the many players they've had who stepped up and been even just above average regulars filling in, right? Getting those types of guys to emerge. That's sort of part of what always made some of St. Louis's teams pop, right? You have these guys that are unheralded coming up and doing good or even great things in some cases, but they do it, of course, with that young core. And we've talked a little about Yordan Alvarez on this show and how great he is. Is Yordan Alvarez for you, so much of the questions we discuss about him in fantasy are about the health of his knees and being, you know, previously UT only and all those kinds of things. But he doesn't walk like Juan Soto does. But just in terms of a young hitter that can do a lot of damage, does he belong closer to the Soto and Vlad conversation than most people are willing to put him? I know those other two guys are better, and I'd rather have both of those guys long term for a few different reasons, but do you feel like Alvarez somehow is underrated in the broader conversation, even though we in the fantasy community clearly appreciate what he can do as a hitter?
I do. He's one of my favorite people to watch, especially in BP. It's just easy, real easy power to all fields. And I think that this year's walk rate underrates him in that regard too. Like, I think that he'll have some 12 to 15% walk rate years in the future, because when I watch him, I think he takes good at bats. It's a little bit different than, you know, Eloy Jimenez and Luis Robert. Like, I like them both a lot, but they don't take the same discipline at bats, even as a Yordan Alvarez. And you can point to walk rates and miss some of the picture there. I think, you know, Alvarez is an Astro. You know, these guys grind things out. They try not to reach. They, you know, they try to make contact. They try to make powerful contact. I think one of the underrated things about the Astros is their ability, you know, to turn out hitters. You know, I think we've been talking about these starting pitchers that they turned out at for $10,000 a piece out of Latin America. But if you watch, one thing that's really interesting about the Astros too is that they all set up very similarly, especially ones that came up through their organization. But even Brantley now, look at how they place their bat against their shoulder before the pitch comes. They all kind of, for the most part, hit their shoulder with the bat and then bring it up like 2 inches, and then that's where their hands are. So they've been part of this, the conversation we're having out here at the Arizona Fall League, about how I think hitter stances are homogenizing. There's been some research about ideal batting stances and ideal techniques at the plate, that you don't have the Craig Counsels anymore. You don't have the Julio Francos anymore. Those batting stances have become homogenized. And I think there's a sort of an opposite thing happening on the pitcher thing, because all the research says that extremes are great. So now you're having more Tyler Rogers, extreme over, extreme under, weird change. You know, like, everyone's trying to be as weird as possible on the mound. Not necessarily mechanically, but like, at least in terms of pitches they're creating. And the hitters are all starting to look the same, frankly, and some of that you can see in the Astros organization.
Yeah, I think it is interesting that we're getting more consistency with the mechanics of hitters, because if you have a simple timing mechanism or a simple start mechanism that just works for everybody to get into that optimal hand position, even if you have something different about maybe the way that you have your feet or other things about the swing that can slightly vary just to kind of fit your body type and what makes you comfortable, having the hands right seems like a very basic thing that could have been done a long time ago or should have been done a long time ago. And it always seemed like hitting was this art where it's like, just do whatever you're comfortable with. And
yes, but there's an optimal path. Like, if you think about it, there's an optimal path from your hands in the set position, the ready position, to getting the bat in the zone quicker. You know what I mean? Like, so there's an optimal path. Like, if I did the Craig Counsel today and had my hands 3-4 inches above my head, I would be adding 6 inches of path.
You would get eaten alive by high fastballs.
I mean, I would get
with
eaten
that.
Alive anyway.
Well, yeah. I mean.
But I think that, yeah, I think you would, yeah, inside fastballs, high fastballs, because you'd have this long bat path.
Yeah, there's just no way you're catching up to high fastballs now. I wonder if players like that would have adjusted, in today's game, but they could do it the way they did.
Yeah, this is not a critique of what came before. It's just, you know, yeah. I think some things like the K-vest have really opened people's eyes I was talking to Matt Lyle, a hitting coach that was with the White Sox for a while. And, you know, I asked him, are there truths with a capital T in hitting? And he said, yes. And I think that's playing out in hitter development now.
Yeah. So I got one more topic that I want to get to, because I guess we could make a series prediction for Red Sox Astros, because it's going to start before the next time we have a show, no show on Friday. I think it's the Astros. I think it's the Astros in six. And I think it is a boatload of runs in this series. It's going to be probably one of the highest scoring series we've ever seen for an ALCS.
I'm just not going to go that far, because you just gave yourself more ways to be wrong.
Oh, I love that.
So I'm going to be more vanilla and be like, you know, Astros in six, and it'll be a great series. How about that?
That's like the best
prediction. Can't prove me wrong on that.
I'm going to really enjoy watching this series. So it comes out like every game's like 2-1, 1-0. I was like, I loved the pitching in that series. Every game's 9-8. I loved how those hitters were just mashing. I don't care that those games took 5 hours. I enjoyed it, because we saw
Astros
more home runs than
four,
ever.
You're like, I enjoyed watching the dominance.
Half my prediction was right. I enjoyed it. Enjoyment is not a real prediction. Well, not in baseball.
If I laugh at this stuff, like, seriously, guys, this is a little stat that I had in my nerds thing. So WAR is the best stat for predicting, for predicting wins, right? It's the best single stat. WAR, wins above replacement, explains 80% of the variance. That's really high. 80% of the variance in wins. If you know a team's WAR, you know how good they are, pretty much. Like, that's an amazing one thing. Like, that's how far we've come. It predicts 6% of the variance in the postseason. And it's the only thing that has, like, a good p-value that, like, you would actually be like, oh, that actually does predict postseasons. And it predicts 6% after it predicts 80% of regular season wins. So, like, when people say that predicting the past is a crapshoot, it is. It literally, that example is the best I can give you.
Even then, if you think about the regular season, if you're predicting 162 games worth of outcomes versus one series, like, it's right. Because you're making it smaller. Like, look what happens within the 162. The chaos happens
within it.
I guess to really
nail that comparison, you have to be like, how much would WAR predict just a random 5-game stretch? Maybe it is only 6%, but still, that's the source of the crapshootedness.
So when you were traveling yesterday, Britt had the very unfortunate task of playing therapist for me as I mourned the end of the Brewers season. And in all of that, I didn't really wax poetic about how great I think this Atlanta team is, but it's a good Atlanta team. I think that was maybe undersold as part of our conversation yesterday, which I'll take full responsibility for, because it was all about me yesterday with how I felt about the Brewers. This is an Atlanta team that had a 3-1 lead in the NLCS against the Dodgers last season. And there are a lot of things about 2020 that I have completely erased from my own memory. That was one that all three of us were like, oh yeah, that actually happened, as we were reminded. Oh yeah, the Braves did win a series. They won 2 last year, but they were up 3-1 in the NLCS against the Dodgers. Yeah, Atlanta had Acuna that year, but the Dodgers were a different team then too. And the strengths of these two teams are still relatively the same. I think Atlanta is more dangerous than most people gave them credit for. I think I gave them proper credit. I said they matched up well with the Brewers. I said their big three could hold their own against the Brewers pitching, and that bared itself out. But I think what makes Atlanta good in my mind is that they have the core, you know, Freeman, Albies, and Austin Riley's kind of stepped up and been an excellent hitter, helping to replace some of that loss with Acuna. But then it's the secondary guys. It is guys like Swanson. Last year it was Travis d'Arnaud. He's not playing at the same level right now. But this is Rosario, Jock Peterson, Adam Duvall. That trio of replacement outfielders, they're flawed players from a sabermetric perspective, but they're dangerous hitters. They can take advantage of mistakes, and that's really what you're looking for from secondary guys. If you have that core of two or three great hitters in place, and you've got four or five other guys that can absolutely do some damage, that makes you pretty dangerous when you put at least three good starters out there and an A bullpen that is an above average unit. Okay, the B bullpen's a problem, fine, but how much does that even matter if your starting pitching does well and isn't overtaxing your relievers?
Yeah, one of the problem is strikeout rate. They had, even with the replacement group in place in September, they had the fourth worst strikeout rate in baseball, not even among the playoff teams. And so I just think that they can be pitched to. And you saw in that series that, you know, it was equal parts really good pitching and not great hitting. That's what kept it low scoring, I thought. You could say it was Burns or Woodruff or whatever, and you know, Anderson and Morton and all them. But I do think that part of it was both offenses were fairly flawed. And I think when you go up against a team that makes more contact, has a higher barrel rate, has a lower reach rate, you're going to see either the Giants or the Dodgers push them more when it comes to runs. You know, so they're going to score more runs than the Brewers did. And yes, the Brewers would have better pitching staff probably than either of these teams. But especially if the Dodgers come out, the Dodgers can match that sort of ace to ace kind of feeling in the Brewers, and then also add more scoring to boot. So I would say that either team that comes out of this game five tonight is a favorite against the Braves.
I would agree. And I think everybody would say, well, the Dodgers would be a bigger favorite than the Giants for the reasons that you mentioned. I think the thing that gives Atlanta a better shot against San Francisco specifically is the Giants pitching staff doesn't pile up strikeouts quite the same way the Dodgers do. Both those teams can do plenty of damage offensively. Both can just outscore Atlanta. And I do think more balls in play against Atlanta's defense is going to, well, like, if I'm just saying that compared to the Brewers, though, it is going to put stress on a very questionable defense.
Mike Pagiola has a great piece out about how in May they just started shifting and never looked back. And my favorite part of the piece is not necessarily all these sort of broad shifting numbers, but he points out that Dansby Swanson was standing within sort of like, you know, 5 feet of second base for one player. It was like when he did the unassisted double play. Mm-hmm. And the spot he was standing in, a Braves shortstop stood in that spot for one pitch in all of 2019. And then over the course of 2020, but in any case, in the course of this season, they've done it 15, 20, 25 times. And it's become not only a team that shifts with a capital S, but a team that does the micro shifting, the little three or four steps to your left and right that seems to be also, frankly, a part of the Giants' success, because the Giants had great defensive numbers, but they have some flawed defensive pieces. You think about Flores, Solano, you know, and then aging guys that used to be really good, but you'd think that they might have fallen off more on defense in Crawford and Longoria. So, you know, the Braves now kind of strike me as a team that makes the most out of their defense in a similar way that the Giants do.
Yeah. No, I think those teams are a little more similar than people previously thought. I think that'd be a great matchup if that's what we get. Again, mentioned before, I think the Dodgers are going to win that game, and it's going to be a Dodgers-Braves matchup to close out the NL. But I'm excited for it nonetheless. Even though I'm disappointed it's not my team playing for the NL pennant, I think we are in store for another great series. Before we go, I'm going to let everyone know, if you don't have a subscription to The Athletic, this is a great time to get one. You can get half off the first year at theathletic.com/ratesandbarrels. You can read all of Eno's stuff, all of Ken Rosenthal's stuff, Jason Stark's stuff, of course, all of Britt's articles, as well as she's on the road for the postseason too. Eno, enjoy Arizona. Say hi to our friends for me, and enjoy at least one extra beer. I said yesterday I want someone to eat all the Portillo's for me. I mean, so I don't know if you can single-handedly do all of it, but get that Portillo's
last night's
going.
Last night's special food option of the evening was brought to us by Woody, listener from Canada, and he brought some Canadian beer and then also all dressed potato chips and some ketchup flavored potato chips. So I had both of those for the first time. All dressed was something around a sour cream and onion, but like a like a sort of a cheddar thing on top of it. And the ketchup was I liked it. I like the ketchup fries. I kind of feel like we need to have more of that in America.
Yeah, I'm on board with that. I also saw there's some kind of like coffee bar candy thing they have in Canada. They have it near the border in a few places, but I've never actually seen one.
Yeah, so he broke out the candy too. So it was a fun night by the fire pit, and I've got a couple more before I head back to the Bay Area. But that was all a preamble for thanks for listening.